Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
All right, we're going to get started. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's great to see such a good turnout tonight. Tonight, we have Emily Chandler. Emily is recently submitted her PhD, which is a great effort, here in the School of the Arts and Media at UNSW. She works in the interdisciplinary fields of media studies and girlhood studies, and she blogs also at girlrepresentationinfilm.wordpress.com. Put that link up on our blog. So without further ado, please make Emily feel welcome.
Good evening, everybody. In this paper, I argue that the Disney Princess franchise maintains its relevance in the lives of adult millennials online via a combination of nostalgia, representational politics, and generational uncertainty. I'm going to begin my presentation by providing a taxonomy of the attributes necessary for a character's inclusion in the franchise. I'll go on to examine how the Disney Corporation has drawn on nostalgia from its beginning to now. I will explore the drive for representation of wider bodily, racial, and sexual diversity in the Disney Princess line. And finally, I will discuss fan artists' corresponding urge to place the princess characters into satirical or transgressive guises as a way of retaining ownership of their stories. Between 1937 and 2016, Walt Disney Animation Studios released 56 animated theatrical films aimed at children and families. Since 2000, the teenage and young adult female protagonists from 11 of these films have been retroactively grouped into a media franchise called the Disney Princesses. These characters include Snow White, Cinderella, Aurora from Sleeping Beauty, Ariel from The Little Mermaid, Belle from Beauty and the Beast, Jasmine from Aladdin, Pocahontas, Mulan, Tiana from The Princess and the Frog, Rapunzel from Tangled, and Merida from Pixar's Brave. This section of my presentation will give a brief history of the franchise. Now, as we all know, the magic of the Disney Princesses all started with one wonderful, inspired man. And that man was Andy Mooney, a former Nike executive who was made the chair of the Walt Disney Company's Consumer Products Division in the late 1990s. While attending his first Disney on Ice show, Mooney noticed that several young girls attending the show were dressed in princess costumes, which were not official Disney products. In an interview with the New York Times, he recalled, "Standing in line in the arena of a Disney on Ice show, I was surrounded by little girls dressed head to toe as princesses. They weren't even Disney products. They were generic princess products. They'd appended to a Halloween costume." And the light bulb went off. Clearly, there was latent demand here. So the next morning, I said to my team, "Okay, let's establish standards and a color palette and talk to licensees and get as much product out there as we possibly can that allows these girls to do what they're doing anyway, projecting themselves into the characters from the classic movies." Now, the Disney buffs among you might notice that the franchise does not include every female character in the Disney animated film canon. There are even princesses from Disney films who don't make the cut. Confusingly, not all of the female characters in the princess lineup are even royal by blood or marriage. Most of them are royalty. Rapunzel, Ariel, Merida, Aurora, and Snow White all inherited their title from their parents. However, it's not necessary to have been born into royalty to be a Disney princess. Belle, Tiana, and Cinderella are commoners who marry princes. They don't necessarily even have to come from a culture that has royalty. Pocahontas is the daughter of the Powhatan tribe's chief, and is never actually referred to as Princess Pocahontas at any point in the film. In fact, in order to be in this franchise, they don't even actually have to be in any kind of ruling or position. Mulan is not of royal birth, nor does she marry a prince, but she's implied to be on the road to marrying a captain in the Chinese army at the end of her film, which is sort of kind of the same thing, I guess, but we'll delve into that. At first glance, it seems that the only thing all the characters have in common is they're young females from Disney animated properties who typically have some sort of claim to a throne. Yet, even if they are princesses, they can't be too young. You're never going to see Ailonwy from The Black Cauldron or the title character from Disney Junior's Sophia the First in the lineup. They must also be from a critically and commercially successful film, ruling out Megara from Hercules and Kida from Atlantis The Lost Empire, who again is actually a princess, but is not included in the lineup for some reason, which we'll get into in a little while. Even if your movie was very successful, the Disney company needs to have full rights to your likeness in order to include you in the lineup. Princess Giselle from 2007's Enchanted, for instance, was going to be included until Disney realized that they would have to pay royalties to her voice and screen actor Amy Adams for, like, the rest of Amy Adams' life, so that ruled her out in a split second. The characters in the franchise come from theatrical Disney films, rather than the lower quality direct-to-video sequels of the 1990s and 2000s, ruling out Melody from The Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea, and Mei, Sue, and Ting Ting from Mulan 2, but all of whom actually have royal parentage. They must also be human women, unlike Lioness Queen Nala from The Lion King and Princess Ada from the Pixar film A Bug's Life. Finally, the Disney princesses tend to come from films which are not current and could use the boost of a franchise. 2013's Frozen, for example, is still so popular among young girls that the sister princesses, Elsa and Anna, usually appear alone on Disney merchandise. And those of you who spend any time in children's toy shops, like me, might have noticed that the title character from Moana, a Disney film released late last year, is also not pictured on merchandise with the other princesses yet. Time will tell whether Moana, Elsa, and Anna are subsumed into the franchise with the other lead characters from successful children's Disney films, but for this reason, I'm not going to discuss these characters in this presentation. So, as we've seen, inclusion in the franchise seems to hinge on being a human, female, lead character, aged between 14 and 21, who is from a successful, but not too current, Disney animated theatrical film. If you're based on a real person, as Pocahontas and Mulan are, that person should be long dead so that they can't claim any royalties. Royal parentage or a royal husband are preferable for a certified Disney princess, but interestingly, they're not essential. Yet even here, there are some slight discrepancies. Pocahontas, for example, is included in the lineup despite the mixed critical reception around her film, which at the time of its release was considered well-meaning with moments of startling beauty, but largely a bland, uninspired effort with uneven plotting and an unfortunate lack of fun. Thus, I find it necessary to delve a little bit deeper into what the princesses have in common. All the princesses, as we can see, are not only young, but conventionally beautiful and graceful. The princesses from Cell animated Disney films spanning the years 1939 to 2009 have slightly more bodily diversity than those in the post-2010 CGI era, going from diminutive Snow White to statuesque Pocahontas to slight wiry Mulan. But every character included in the franchise has a trim figure without wide hips or prominent breasts. Most female characters who are overweight in Disney films tend to be mothers or villains, whose body fat disqualifies them from being viable love interests. However, curvaceous young female characters like Esmeralda from The Hunchback of Notre Dame and Charlotte LaBeouf of The Princess and the Frog, who are neither mothers nor villains, are also absent from the lineup. This indicates to me that wide hips, heavy breasts, and other signifiers of sexuality may be a disqualifying factor. According to Claire Bradford, the innocence of the princesses is constructed through comparisons with more knowing and sexually available figures, such as the bimbettes in Beauty and the Beast. Belle's high-necked blue and white dress is set against the bimbettes' plunging necklines, which evoke stereotypes of the saucy medieval wench, and Belle's decorous behavior is compared with the bimbettes' bodily performances, which are coded as promiscuous. So, with this in mind, possible reasons for the exclusion of, you know, curvaceous or, you know, seemingly sexual characters from the lineup could be that curves are read as necessarily sexual, Alternatively, it could also be because a particularly developed figure might alienate the prepubescent girls who these characters are actually being marketed to. Of the roster of princesses, Snow White, Cinderella, Aurora, Ariel, Belle, Rapunzel, and Merida are European and white. By European, I mean that their films take place either in locales in Europe, such as France, or Europe-inspired fairy tale lands, such as Rapunzel's island nation of Corona, which is based nominally on parts of Germany and Spain. Jasmine, Pocahontas, Mulan, and Tiana are, respectively, Middle Eastern, Native American, Chinese, and African American. Now, none of the Disney princesses actually live in the present day. This is to be expected. As of 2017, 101 Dalmatians, Lilo and Stitch, and Bolt are the only Disney films that take place at the time of their release, rather than in the past or the future. However, of the characters in the Disney Princess franchise, the women of color are more likely to live in a specified time and place, whereas the white princesses are more likely to live in generic fairy tale lands or else in a particular country in an unspecified long ago period. The decision to include characters who are women of color in the Disney Princess franchise serves to reinforce Disney's plausibility as a multicultural brand. This ensures that girls of a range of racial backgrounds have at least one princess to identify with. However, the inclusion of one East Asian character, one black character, one Native American, and one Middle Eastern character, alongside a bevy of white princesses, gives one pause. For example, Tiana, much feted as Disney's first black princess, lives in New Orleans in the 1920s and is of an age to have lost her father in World War I. Rather than depicting Tiana neatly escaping racism, The Princess and the Frog touches delicately on the fact that Tiana is subject to institutional limitations as a young black woman pre-civil rights by showing real estate agents refusing to sell property to a young woman of her background. The production of films about women of color and the selection of these female characters of color for the Princess franchise seems to hinge on the logic that each princess of color is representative of her entire race, whereas the stories that can be told about white people are endless, and that the princesses of color need more justification for having a story about them, hence their more frequent grounding in reality. If we return to this nifty Venn diagram that I made, we see that there are occasional exceptions. Jasmine, for example, lives in Agrabah, which is a medieval fantasy Middle Eastern city straight out of a Christmas pantomime. But the overall logic is that it is normal and logical for a princess to be white. The princesses of color require extra explanation for their presence and their princesshood if they are to be permitted to serve as the primary ambassador for their race. The princesses of color often clash against their culture in some way. They are exceptional because they are shown to resist or discard backward elements of their cultures. Jasmine defies the requirement that she marry a prince. Pocahontas chooses to walk in the footsteps of a stranger through her romance with white John Smith. Mulan dresses as a soldier to save her father. And Tiana overcomes the assumption that black women cannot be successful in business. However, even with these little moves that Disney makes to justify the mere presence of women of color so that it can reach a wider demographic, Mulan, Jasmine, Pocahontas, and Tiana tend to get shunted to the side in favor of the white princesses. Writing in 2015, Ilana Nash argues, "Merchandising reveals what matters most in the Disney princess lifestyle brand. A glance at Disney's online store shows that the least sexualized and least romantically oriented princesses, Mulan and Pocahontas, have the fewest products in their likeness. Even the few that exist are not widely distributed. The websites of Target and Walmart, two of America's largest retailers, offer broad arrays of Disney princess trinkets, but virtually none with a Mulan or Pocahontas theme. At the other end of the spectrum, the princess with the greatest amount of widely available merchandise is, not surprisingly, Cinderella, more than 50 years after its release as a Disney film." Considering that Nash was writing in 2015, I went on the Disney Store's online hub a couple of days ago. As this graph shows, it listed 180 Belle products compared to just 8 Tiana products. The princesses with the least products in their likeness are all women of color. The only white princess with as few products as them is Merida, who is a tomboy with no romantic storyline in her film. Arguably, until the 2010s, few of the princesses took on the star personas of their voice actors. While some successful Hollywood stars, such as Eva Gabor, Phil Harris, and Mickey Rooney, have lent their voices to Disney animated films prior to the Disney Renaissance era of the 1990s, This was not typically something that young female stars did at the height of their careers, hence the reason why most people don't know who any of these people are or which princesses they actually voiced. Since the Disney princesses are rarely associated with their relatively unknown voice actors, such as the Broadway singer Paige O'Hara in the middle over there and the TV actress Ming-Na Wen over here, this means that they remain eternally young. Since these characters never age, and since so many of Disney's films take place in the past or in fantasy lands, Disney films are often described as timeless. However, they're often very much of their time. Cinderella's appearance and costuming has a definite Grace Kelly quality, whereas Princess Aurora epitomizes Christian Dior's new look with her tiny waist and full-skirted three-quarter-length dress. Meanwhile, the similarity between Jasmine's garb and the baggy pants, halter tops, and long hair held in scrunchies that were part of the year's Southern California dress code at the time the film is released is absolutely uncanny. That the princesses remain eternally young and beautiful makes them endlessly malleable. In the marketing and merchandising, the princesses' personalities are often flattened and homogenized. For example, Disney rarely produces toys or illustrations of the princesses in their civilian clothing from their humble beginnings, such as Cinderella's, servant dress or Aurora's peasant outfit from her time living as Briar Rose. Belle, for instance, is often pictured with a mirror in hand. In Beauty and the Beast, Belle uses the magic mirror to see across vast space. However, in the merchandising, Belle is often positioned looking into the mirror as though merely gazing at her own features, something at odds with Belle's lack of preoccupation with physical appearance in the film. Furthermore, wherever the princess characters are pictured, it's usually in their princess gowns. Mulan and Pocahontas, arguably the most resourceful of the bunch, are rarely depicted on princess merchandise because their rustic garb has less bling potential than that of old-school heroines like Sleeping Beauty. Hence, we can see with these, like, super, super awkward Pocahontas recut designs here. Furthermore, in 2012, all of the principal princess characters received official redesigns, which further downplayed the differences in their personalities, nationalities, and origins by sparklifying their outfits, lengthening their hair, and downplaying racial markers. For example, Mulan's skin was lightened. Her eye color was also lightened until it appeared almost blue-green in some pictures. Her cheeks were rouged, her figure became curvier, and her face was lengthened. This and other acts of whitewashing on the non-white princesses did not stir as much controversy as tomboyish Merida's reimagining as thinner with a bigger bust, more revealing dress, a face full of makeup, less wild hair, and replacing her signature bow and arrows with a sassy little sash. Across the board, the downplaying of their individuality for marketing purposes was of concern for parents, academics, feminists, and Disney fans. Female characters in Disney animated films, including the characters included in the Princess franchise, indicate the changing nature of American womanhood between the 1930s and the 2010s. While the princess characters from the 1930s to the 1960s concern themselves mainly with housework and dreaming of the arrival of romantic love, from the 1990s, many of the princesses yearned for that elusive something more, which often arrives via finding romantic love. Across the board, few of the Disney princesses have a developed sense of humour. Some, like Rapunzel, can be mildly quirky or occasionally clumsy, with a portion of the film's humour resulting from their embarrassment. Tiana and Mulan each take part in some limited physical comedy in each of their films. However, within the films, across the board, humour is something that happens to these characters, not something that results from their own wordplay or their point of view. While the characters arguably range from fairly flat to more developed, all of them have an intrinsic warmth. They're friendly and charming, even to those who have little means with which to repay their kindness. Ilana Nash argues that post-1989, Disney expanded its traditional definition of feminine goodness to include new qualities, while not jettisoning the older ones. No longer patient, meek, or obedient, latter-day princesses have strong desires and act upon them, but they still display traditional feminine goodness, selflessness, loyalty to parents, and a desire, or at least a willingness, to find true love with a man. Moreover, it is seldom the princess's conscious decisions or actions that secure her final outcome. Ultimately, a Disney princess's ability to transform relies on her essential goodness, which motivates more potent actions and choices of others. When Andy Mooney first proposed turning the princesses into a franchise, the idea of promoting characters from different Disney films as part of the same franchise was very controversial at the company. Notably, Walt Disney's nephew Roy, a senior executive at Disney, objected strongly to the plans for a franchise. The marketing team eventually came up with an ingenious solution for marketing the princesses together while maintaining their separate mythologies. Let's see if you guys can spot what it is. Here are some Disney princesses having a tea party. Here they are celebrating Christmas. And here they are enjoying the changing seasons. Can you see how the marketing team has kept them separate even as they all hang out together? No takers? The costuming, yes, but they never actually interact, even if they're all in the same illustration. They don't touch each other, they don't speak to each other, and crucially, they don't make eye contact with each other. Personally, I've always found that incredibly creepy, not least because it's absolutely, absolutely deliberate, not the result of shonky graphic design. More recently, the Disney princesses have appeared in the Disney Junior series Sophia the First as mentors to Sophia, the first child princess character marketed to children after the advent of the Disney Princess franchise. In the TV series, the official princesses always show up individually, give advice, sing a little song, and then depart. You'll never see them banding together to defeat a common enemy. So as much as I may yearn for a sort of Avengers with Disney princesses, that's not going to happen for a long, long time. The Disney Princess franchise is primarily aimed at children, but has increasing prevalence in the lives of young adults, even those who don't have children themselves. However, responses to the marketing in the form of Disney Princess discourse online, fan discussions, fan art, videos, and editorials show some fascinating trends. This paper will catalogue and explore some of the online Disney discourse around the current roster of Disney princesses: Belle, Mulan, Pocahontas, Jasmine, Cinderella, Snow White, Ariel, and Merida. This paper is not intended to serve as an indictment or as a glorification of Disney princess culture, as I don't think that Disney princess culture deserves either complete condemnation or complete acceptance. It is my intention, however, to open a new area in the dialogue about Disney princess culture, to move from discussions of the princess's suitability for children to begin exploring what they mean for adult fans. I begin by just considering what role nostalgia is playing here. It's impossible to talk about Disney without invoking nostalgia, or without prompting nostalgia in listeners. In the 2010s, the internet seems gripped by a powerful wave of the stuff. The word nostalgia originates in medical discourse. It was first coined to describe a pathological phenomenon in which Swiss soldiers and students abroad pined for home to the degree that they began to experience insomnia, anorexia, melancholic madness, or abjectness. A modern definition of nostalgia is a state of longing for something which is known to be irretrievable. However, this definition doesn't adequately reflect the place of nostalgia in contemporary life. In the 2010s, millennials' nostalgia is more likely to look a bit like this. The term of feeling nostalgic is more likely to be used to describe pleasurable emotions associated with a particular period, and or a longing to return to this period. People often publicly indulge in nostalgia as a point of connection with others, and as we can see from the existence of Pottermore, Pokemon Go, and the 2017 Power Rangers movie, advertisers have learned to harness nostalgia for commercial gain. The prevalence of Disney nostalgia among millennials is broadly attributable to the fact that the Disney company has dealt in nostalgia from its inception. Disney films in the golden and silver eras, such as Snow White, Pinocchio, The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, were often adaptations of fairy tales or classic children's literature. After a long period of stagnation in which the company made missteps by adapting less well-known properties, such as Marjorie Sharp's The Rescuers and Lloyd Alexander's The Black Cauldron, Disney was able to regain their position as the top animation studio in the West by returning to adaptations of fairy tales and classics like The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Aladdin. From this chart, we can see that it's shaping up to be something of a pattern for the Disney company. So, classics, stagnation, classics, stagnation. We're entering more what's called the revival or the new renaissance in some Disney fans' eyes. But yeah, you can see that the classic stagnation pattern has been established up to now. So it'll be interesting to see where the company goes from here. Discussing the Disney Renaissance of 1989 to 1999, Keith Booker argues that it means one thing to make Snow White in 1937 and something entirely different to remake it half a century later. The element of nostalgia for an earlier and presumably more authentic time that was already present in the earlier films becomes significantly stronger in films of the 1990s, because these films now have the added element of nostalgia for the earlier films. Even before the Disney Renaissance, the Disney theme parks included representations of small-town America, based on Walt Disney's recollections of his own boyhood, in a place where no one worked in factories or in personal offices. In a park guide from the 1960s, Walt Disney told patrons walking Main Street in Disney World, "We hope you'll visualize, as I often do, your own hometown Main Street, or the one your parents or grandparents may have told you about." Gary Cross observes that in this setting, adults enjoyed a nostalgia that recalled youth, even if it wasn't their own youth, and children were expected to play their parts in the timeless wonder of the scene. Thus, unlike other nostalgic properties such as Harry Potter, Pokemon, and Power Rangers, Disney has been nostalgic at its very core for 75 plus years. Many millennials first encountered Disney at home on VHS and DVD. The influence of home video on the Disney brand is incalculable. The Walt Disney Company became a home video juggernaut through ingenious marketing of its beloved animated films. From the early 1980s, Disney started to market its most profitable films as Walt Disney Classics. After 1994 came the Walt Disney Masterpieces Collection, and from 2000 to 2003, the Walt Disney Gold Classics Collection. These featured holographic stickers as an anti-piracy measure, and often came in hard plastic clamshell cases. Each video cassette began with a logo animation of Mickey Mouse, Cinderella's Castle, or Tinkerbell, usually with an instrumental version of When You Wish Upon a Star, which from Pinocchio, which is the Disney Company's unofficial theme tune. During its home video era, Disney also instituted a practice known as the Disney Vault, in which each Disney film was available for purchase for a limited time, after which it was put in the vault, and was not made available in stores for several years until it was once again re-released. In the intervening years, VHS or DVD copies of the film would sell for vastly inflated prices on sites like eBay. With the advent of digital streaming and torrenting, the Disney Vault is no longer a feasible marketing strategy. Hence, the Walt Disney Company has moved to issuing big-budget live-action remakes of their most popular properties. Maleficent, Cinderella, The Jungle Book, and Beauty and the Beast have all achieved a great deal of box office success, establishing a favourable precedent for the upcoming remakes of The Lion King, Aladdin, and Mulan. With the sheer weight of all this, the millennials have become accustomed from their earliest years to the idea of childhood media as something that you revisit over and over again. In my own experience, I visualize this by comparing my mother with my older sister. My mother, born in 1960 and raised on Disney films but in Saturday morning cinema matinees once weekly, is bewildered at the sight of her children watching their favorite Disney films on repeat from infancy into their teens and 20s. Since in her experience, films are something that you watch once and then never again, maybe like 20 years later. My sister, on the other hand, born in 1986 and raised with slews of Disney films on VHS in the house, happily bonds with her small daughter, born in 2012, over a mutual love of Beauty and the Beast and Cinderella. My sister and her daughter, a generation apart, but both interacting with Disney in the same way. The combined power of nostalgia and marketing has rendered the Disney princesses the arbiter of proper femininity. They fulfill everything asked of women in Western culture and seemingly appear everywhere that Western culture permeates. Curiously, they often seem to appear in places that don't have any children in them, blogging platforms like Tumblr and popular news sites like BuzzFeed. On these websites, you can often see adult women asking for Disney to create a princess who looks like them. Similarly, in the This Is What a Disney Princess Could Look Like campaign on Tumblr, people submit art pieces and selfies as examples of what Disney princesshood could look like. I'd like to direct your attention to this example from 2013, wherein the caption reads, "I'm pansexual with a preference for women. I'm fat, I'm not physically very attractive, I have a mental illness that I need to take medication for to be able to function. I'd like to think I can still be a princess." That final line, "I'd like to think I can still be a princess," stands out to me. I argue that the Disney Princess franchise ultimately sells a fantasy of getting to feel special. On the official Disney Princess website, their marketing reads, "For a little girl, the desire to feel special is more powerful than a magic wand. She dreams of a place where clothes are spun of silk and gold, where balls are given in her honor, and where princes fall in love at first sight. It is a world Disney has created, full of fantasy and romance, where a girl can feel as special as a princess. Disney Princess, where dreams begin." As Ilana Nash writes, "It sounds nice when we tell children they can be anything they want to be. But in reality, what we become depends more on abilities and circumstances than it does on simple desire. That inconvenient fact disappears in the rhetoric of fantasy and empowerment, where merely being yourself, a self which is automatically special because it exists, promises ultimate success. Small wonder that millennial children love Disney's princesses, whose essential specialness is unfailingly rewarded. If you're good, you get to feel special. Disney princesses are the pinnacle of feminine goodness and thus can feel the most special. Hence, you'll see people arguing passionately for the inclusion of characters like Mulan, who is neither born into royalty nor went to royalty, or Princess Leia from Star Wars, who is not a character created by Disney, but whose universe has recently been acquired by Disney, in the Disney Princess franchise. It is not that people are arguing for the royal status or Disney-ness of these characters. Rather, these characters are beloved, particularly in feminist or geeky circles, and so people want them to be bestowed with the ultimate banner of specialness, inclusion in the Disney Princess lineup. This provides more context for the art pieces that you see on your Facebook feed each morning, linked from BuzzFeed. The Disney princesses in seemingly infinite guises. As elderly, as plus-sized, as other races, as queer, as disabled. As the internet has allowed these groups and their allies a voice, they petition for recognition of their right to feel special by creating Disney princesses that resemble them. A related phenomenon sees people ranking and quantifying the Disney princesses' feminism. The idea seems to be that if Disney princesses are feminist, it makes being a feminist okay, even desirable. Thus we see articles like BuzzFeed's recent listicle, "Disney princesses ranked from least to most feminist." Snow White, for instance, is ranked the second least feminist only because she's awake for more of her film than Aurora in Sleeping Beauty. Nevertheless, she is described disparagingly as the most spineless princess in the entire Disney universe. The author, Beatrice Serrano, continues, "Snow White has to run away because, according to a mirror, she's prettier than the queen. Snow White escapes after they try to murder her, and a group of friendly animals lead her to a house inhabited by 7 dwarves. So, what is the first thing dumb Snow White does when she enters a house that belongs to 7 guys? She starts cleaning it until it's spick and span. Moral of the story, no feminism." This article, like many similar ones that you'll find online, accepts the notion of the princesses as timeless by eliding the princesses' origins in wildly different decades. There is no admission that Snow White was created in the late 1930s. In the film, Snow White has an extremely Depression-era mentality that there's no use in griping when things are difficult, and that she must make the best of her dire circumstances with a positive attitude. When some cute woodland critters discover her crying in the woods after fleeing the hitman hired by her evil stepmother, Snow White even exclaims, "I'm so ashamed of the fuss I've made." So, what is the motivation here for chiding a character created when my grandmother was a child for not properly embodying millennials' feminist ideals? We don't ask that of lots of characters in 1930s films. In an era when feminism is popularly understood to be about individualized choices, the media people consume needs to always be politically expedient. It is not enough to like something just because it's fun. It needs to show off your feminist credentials. Hence, feminism is used as an objective metric of quality. According to Andy Zeisler, this illustrates some of the disquieting facets of marketplace feminism, namely that the descriptor feminist now seems to be used to lavish praise on anything that isn't overtly degrading, demeaning, or exploitative to women. Another is that arguments over whether a movie is feminist or not feminist, especially when that movie never intended to claim either, suggest that feminism is not a set of values, ethics, and politics, but merely an assessment of whether or not a product is worthy of consumption. The idea that we can love our and prize our childhood memories only if they align perfectly with our values as adults is what I'd like you all to keep in mind as I move into the next and final session on using the Disney princesses to explore transgression. There is another thread of Disney princess fan art and discussion which uses the princess characters to explore themes of satire and transgression. In these kinds of fan art, artists deconstruct the characters by playing up the most uncomfortable elements and using the darkest possible interpretations. For example, Jeffrey Thomas's Twisted Princess fan art series imagines each of the princesses, as well as other female Disney characters, as monstrous hybrids, undead horrors, and lone warriors out to avenge the deaths, usually of their princes, but sometimes of their families. The characters are pictured covered with scars and burn marks, in torn clothing with clouded eyes and rictus grins, wielding some combination of dark magic and bloodied weapons. Many of the art pieces come with a paragraph intended to provide context for the image. One of the shorter ones accompanies the reimagining of Mulan. It reads, "Here's my latest princess. She's my new favorite. I hope you guys like her. The story behind her design is that the Huns destroy Mulan's village, killing everyone, including her. Her ancestors send Mushu to retrieve the spirits of their fallen family. Upon collecting Mulan's spirit, she begs Mushu to restore her spirit to her body so that she can defeat the Huns and avenge the death of her family. Mushu does so, but in order to bring her back to life, he must fuse his body with hers. When he does, he becomes a living tattoo on her body, his appearance altered by Mulan's rage and hatred for the Huns. So Mulan is essentially a zombie fueled by revenge, ha ha ha." The later art pieces are paired with long chunks of narrative text describing the deaths of each princess's true love or family members in extreme detail. Similar series include photographer Dina Goldstein's Fallen Princesses, in which models portray the Disney princesses having miserable lives after the presumed happy ending, and the Redditor Grumpy Punk Cat series Disney Unhappily Ever After, which shows the princesses navigating a world with racism, global pandemics, animal cruelty, and drug abuse. If these characters are such a focus of nostalgia and are held in such loving regard by so many people, what's the motivation for seeing them brought low in these kinds of art pieces? To understand the thought process behind these kinds of art pieces, I would look first to the grim, gritty, grounded media trend which began in superhero comics of the 1980s and has since pervaded every corner of screen media. Frank Miller's comics of the 1980s commented on the post-Vietnam War, Reagan era, using tropes such as dystopian hellscapes riddled with violent crime, psychotic killers committing brutal murders, stoic, stubbly-faced heroes cloaked in the shadows. However, as this aesthetic was widely reproduced by other artists for other properties, the quality of the work was misunderstood as deriving from its grittiness. According to Jeff Carter, realistic and grounded are the new cinematic buzzwords when it comes to adapting America's cape and tights clad icons. Words like lightheartedness, humor, adventure, fantasy, optimism, idealism, hope, inspiration, and righteousness are now taboo. They have no place in the real world. There will be no cracking jokes or saving innocence or any hokey old-timey values like virtue and decency in this realm of grime and brooding and the old ultra-violence, thank you very much. In superhero and geek fandom, we see widespread efforts to disown any aspects of the original works which are considered childish and to promote the grim, gritty, grounded aspects, since these are seen as the most legitimate interpretation of a work. If we apply this logic to Disney fan art, one possible interpretation for works like Twisted Princesses and Fallen Princesses is that as ubiquitous as the Disney princesses are, adults still regard them as something of a guilty pleasure. Guilty pleasures can be defined as anything which people enjoy despite being aware that it is generally considered to be low quality, weird, esoteric, or poorly regarded. Typically feminine and or childish pursuits are the most likely to be regarded as guilty pleasures. Thus, fans find it necessary to invoke darkness in order to legitimize their continued interest in Disney. Furthermore, living in a post-9/11 world with a 24-hour news cycle means that people are made hyper-aware of how awful the world can be. In such an environment, it can be difficult to relate to the optimism of childhood media. Fans can thus take a cynical delight in seeing these beloved characters brought low, seeing them fail to evade the darkness that seems to permeate so much of society. This is my favourite piece of Disney Princess fan art ever, so I'm going to end on it. In presenting nostalgia, representation, and transgression as motivating factors for millennials' interest in Disney princesses, I argue that they are densely intertwined. People born between 1982 and 2000 consumed Disney in a way no generation had previously been able to, over and over on home video, committing every line and joke and song to memory. These characters and stories of millennials' childhood years, already rendered timeless at their inception, have been kept current through the urgency of franchise marketing. Nostalgia can feel only natural to a generation who have grown accustomed to diving back into their favourite stories whenever they wish. But with an urge to take our collective pasts with us into the future comes a profound sense of unease. The past is truly a foreign country, one that we cannot return to. It is an unhappier, more exclusionary place than we can comfortably admit, yet so rose-tinted and joyful that it becomes painful to behold in our current state. Hence, remaking the stories from our past, even as we revisit them, is one way of resolving the dilemma of millennial adulthood. Thank you very much.
Hello, my name is Meg. I'm from the School of Social Sciences, and thank you so much for inviting me to come and talk to you guys today and to listen to your talk. It was a wonderful presentation. It was actually a very pertinent area of discussion in terms of princess culture, which has been rather, it's almost like a buzzword now in contemporary feminism today. So I actually look at girls in Japan who wear cute clothes and in many respects try to become their own kind of princess. Mm-hmm. Not so much Disney princess, but shoujo culture, so little lady culture. And it was very interesting to see the parallels between what's happening in Japan mm-hmm. and their fan cultures and what's happening, I guess, overseas in Australia, America, mm-hmm. and other international countries in terms of how they're incorporating Disney princesses into their own lives.
Definitely.
So I've prepared some questions. So one of the interesting things that you mentioned was the intergenerational kinship and mm-hmm. the exchange of the mutual love of Disney princess between mother and child.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's... What is it in that sharing of culture and values between mother and daughter? Is there something particularly special about that that transforms mm-hmm. into adult life for women later?
I mean, I would say so. I know that this past summer when I went to Perth to see my older sister, I was like trying frantically to bond with my 5-year-old niece because I only see her about 2 or 3 times a year. And so it seemed that, I remember one day my 5-year-old niece turned to me and said, like, Auntie M. And I said, yes, darling. And she said, Auntie M, what did you and Mummy used to watch on Netflix when you were little? And I nearly started laughing, and I'm glad I didn't, because that is not only like quite rude, but I realized that throughout this entire 3-week visit, in order to like bond with her, seemingly every 5 minutes I kept, you know, saying like, oh, Angelina Ballerina or The Wiggles or Maisie or Sleeping Beauty or Beauty and the Beast. Mm. Oh, Mummy and I used to watch that when we were little, like just like you, bond with me.
Mm.
And so, yeah, from the point of view of a 5-year-old, why wouldn't she think that Netflix had existed 20 years ago when seemingly everything else that she enjoys and does also seem to exist for all time?
Mm.
And so... Yeah, I think that especially since the, you know, the advent of home video, it's become possible for, like, yeah, women born in the 80s and women born in the 2010s to, yeah, bond over this very similar experience. I'm curious to see, since children of my niece's generation will grow up with streaming media, like, you know, so not only... not only videotapes and DVDs, but, like, the opportunity to, I guess, like, marathon things. I'm wondering how that will affect, you know, the generational transmission of, like, love for Disney in the future. But I think it's a very, potent part of Disney culture, you know, this this transmission, this bonding between particularly mothers and daughters, I find.
So that's just two thoughts that are coming to mind at once when you're talking about this. So first of all, just coming to what you're saying in terms of particular media or particular characters defining childhood and our childhood cultures now, it's very media-based. And I think, you know, as generations go on, different things define childhood and adulthood and that sort of thing. What do you think it is about the particular period that you identify that's now being repeated? It's not just Disney Princess, but it's also things I'm thinking now of, like Polly Pocket, Littlest Pet Shop, Barbie. Many franchises are now being repeated and reinvented for current generations in a way that we've not really, off the top of my head, seen before in, say, earlier generations or earlier cultural creations like Enid Blyth and things like that.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think that, I mean, I touched in my presentation on, you know, the, I guess, the feelings of goodwill that are associated with, like, particular media franchises. And, yeah, I think the, you know, marketing, the tried and true nature of it, you know, the idea that, you know, if a million kids liked this 20 years ago, there's got to be something in there that appeals in some way to children across all, you know, all generations.
One of the interesting things is that with the reinvention and reboots of particular franchises is the way in which they reinterpret and stylize the forms. So particularly with Barbie, a lot of scholars who have studied Barbie's transformation over the decades note particularly the change in her eyes and her face. So if you look at Barbie from the 1950s, she's got a very sort of smug sort of, you know, very sort of side eye going on there. And she sort of is transformed. Her eyes become bigger and bigger and bigger in the 80s in particular, when it's a, you know, around the same time in which you see beauty competitions. If you compare, say, beauty pageants to the 80s to now, the beauty pageants of the 80s looked like Barbie, like beautiful, massive flowing dresses, massive sleeves, big hair, questionable makeup. But, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how these styles are being reinvented. And in a way, that kind of reminded me of one of the things you were mentioning on your slides about how the Barbie Princess franchise was reinvented to become more beautified. What values do you think might be inscribed in that?
I think that, I guess the sense of, I mean, one of my pet peeves that in most children's media franchises for girls these days is, this phenomenon of sort of same face syndrome, where like every single female character will have more or less the same face with like different hair and a different costume and maybe like different paint on the face, but always the same basic model. And I'm aware that, you know, I'm fully aware that this is done, you know, because everything is about like merchandising. You know, they want to be able to make dolls of these characters, and you know, it's like it's like more cost effective to use the same mold for all of the dolls. But as pertains to the Disney princesses, I think that this sort of air of like difference and homogenization is very important, like the two sort of intermingling and coexisting. So for instance, you know, even the Disney princess dolls that you see, they've all got the same basic face mold, just painted differently to maybe like, you know, emphasize an eye shape or like the, you know, no bridge of nose or very tiny bridge of nose.
Or the different plastics used to change the color of their skin.
Definitely.
Very rarely, but sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in my research, I've sort of found that, like part of, you know, for instance, in the BuzzFeed video that we saw, one of the women who was interviewed said that as a child, you know, everybody expected that she would be Pocahontas or Jasmine, even though she's, you know, Indian. So she's, you know, that she's not remotely from either of those parts of the world originally. And yeah, like very much in children's marketing for girls, there's this sort of racial non-specificity, so that girls of different, you know, of wildly different, you know, cultural origins can all project themselves onto the same doll. You know, people expect everybody to, every, you know, East Asian little girl to project herself onto Mulan, whether or not she even likes swords and fighting, because, yeah, Mulan is, you know, Mulan is the Asian one, and, like, Pocahontas is the, you know, the Native American one, but, like, every other little girl who bears some sort of physical resemblance to her is expected to identify with her.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, with this in mind, in terms of, so you're saying that the stylization in particular with dolls comes from, one, you know, cost, you know, making it, you know, more cost efficient, but also in terms of perhaps it's a design strategy, so particular, it's to maximize the potential a doll has in being identifiable with a child, thinking, oh, that's me. You know, in a lot of ways, that's quite common with other studies of Barbie as well, that irrespective of how you package and present the Barbie can be subject to any kind of identity projected upon her.
Yeah.
So what do you think are with the hopes of Disney's textual creators in making these dolls that anyone can pick up and say, oh, this is me? Like, what are they acting out?
I mean, something that stands out to me is a recorded quote from Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was the CEO at Disney for a period in the 1990s, I think. He was overheard one day scolding some of his animators, I think, saying, you know, we're not here to make art, we're not here to make a statement. You know, he said that, you know, that cost and profit, you know, came above all else. And while I think there is, like, a great deal of artistry and a great deal of integrity in a lot of the Disney films, you only need to see, you know, like the fact that in recent years the writers do seem to have listened to a lot of the criticisms of particularly their female characters and updated their stories, you know, to, you know, like to address those concerns. This can also be, I guess, because of a fear that people won't buy the merchandise or see the films if they feel like you know, these things are presenting like a bad example for their daughters. You know, there was a recent advertisement for the franchise itself called the I Am a Princess campaign. It was a very stirring advertisement showing sort of little girls watching Disney princess films in like an open air cinema, and it's, you know, it's like very romantic looking. It's out in the woods and it's all strung with fairy lights, and they're kind of gazing in wonderment up at you know, I think Rapunzel saying very stirringly that she you know, when she makes a promise, she never ever goes back on that promise. And then it sort of shows the girls like mountain biking and doing karate and other things like that. And so I think while you know, while I certainly don't think that like everybody who works at the Disney company is like cynical and profit driven 100% of the time, I don't think they would be doing this if they didn't think that yeah, that it was commercially commercially beneficial to do so.
It's kind of interesting how in this way, like, toys, which once had such symbolic significance, you know, as a social fact, in that, you know, one would be able to reenact something that their parents was doing, or they might be able to imagine something, it's becoming almost hollow through mass production. Because if the symbolic meaning is not attached to it by producers, then it must be in some way attached to it by consumers. But I think if you would ask any mother, why did you buy this doll for your child, they're going to say, because my child likes it, not for some particular reason. So that's what I think is so interesting, is like the machine, the production machine is becoming so fast now that any kind of meaning that might be attributed to these characters in the first place in the original Disney films is progressively becoming lost. Did you want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit glib, but I can't help but think of on blogging platforms like Tumblr, there's been like a great revival in sort of photoshopping Princess Aurora, because the character, so even though she was created in the late 1950s, has like an epic case of what we would refer to as like resting bitch face days. there's a great vogue for people photoshopping her, you know, dropping sick burns on the other Disney princesses and like, you know, just destroying their self-esteem. So even though when this character was designed and animated, you know, she was intended to be very graceful and very admirable and very beautiful. But yeah, there's just something around around the choices that they made that that has caused people to latch onto her and like dub her, you know, the professional mean girl of the lineup.
Yeah, I did particularly think during your talk of the Mean Girls parody with Disney princesses substituted in the trailer.
Yeah,
like I think that's one of the more iconic memes going around, particularly with young women who are consuming kawaii media internationally, so cute girly media. So one of the other things I was sort of thinking about in terms of this bonding with children over common things, particularly in Japan, this is significant because women there try to share between like grandmother to mother to child this sense of love and nurturing and care. So if we just put the feminist stuff to one side for a second it's quite a maternalistic kind of thing. As kawaii is very much about caring for people as much as it is being cute and wanting to be cared for. So in this way, the princess culture of Japan is trying to translate that in trying to share things. So, and it also extends to things like Hello Kitty. So this is like Disney princess, Hello Kitty is something that a mother can relate with their child and can continue to carry through her life through little phone charms and things like that. So do you think there are any like values or kinship or anything that's tied between mother and child through Disney princess, or is that kind of getting lost now?
I think that you know, the like little girls in many cultures are sort of socialized, you know, into a, you know, into what I refer to in my own research as like middle class white niceness. So, you know, kindness, but also you know, self sacrifice and caring for others. So I think while it's not necessarily sinister, I imagine that for a lot of mothers, the I guess the courageousness and but also, you know, like unfailing kindness of the Disney princesses is what sort of appeals as characters to relate with. I imagine that it's sort of the similar to a lot of fathers, you know, bonding with their sons over superheroes, you know, truth and justice in the American way.
Well, and of course that would have some more extreme sort of masculine gender roles that we could, like, you know, lift out and separate from superheroes and then look at what's left. Because I think a lot of the debate about, you know, Disneyfication and the Disney princess syndrome and things like that tends to get very distracted by the gender roles and not looking at the core what the children are actually can also consuming. So for example, like, you know, Postman Pat, Fireman Sam, you know, they have gender roles in them, but in there's also so much more substance to that.
I think that the you know, the fact that so many of the Disney princesses, while people do rightfully criticize, you know, this like self-sacrifice aspect, they're acting out of sort of pure love is like very powerful for a lot of people who are viewing this. I remember watching one of my nieces when she was two, the first film that I watched all the way through with her was Frozen. And at the end, the two sisters, you know, they hug and their beautiful love saves the kingdom. I looked over at her and she was so swept up in what was happening in the film that she was hugging herself, like, really tightly. you know, just, just, like, aww, captivated by this moment. And, so I think that as critical as I can be of this franchise, I think it's very important to acknowledge that that was the part she was swept up by, not like the cleaning in Snow White, not the, you know, the being locked in a tower in Beauty and the Beast. She was focused on, this moment of like all-powerful love being sort of transformative.
I think you find that in a lot of Disney texts, like even if it's like Aladdin or something like that, where the main character is not female. One of the main drives, even like Lion King, I'm thinking as well. I think love is one of the key messages to all of those texts, and they explore love in different ways. And I think aside from the more cynical fact that, you know, Disney is so prolific and such a big force that there's actually some substance to these texts that drives people to pick them up again and again and again. So that's what I think is particularly interesting. But moving away from the mother and child things, I know your main contribution to knowledge with this is particularly the fan cultures around Disney. So what was really interesting is that you pointed out the transformational properties of being able to imagine I could also be a princess. So this transformation, I could be a princess, and being able to transcend your own everyday limitations, but in some cases take those limitations with you. So like, you know, the different iterations of Disney princess, and I think there was one, like, was there one with disabilities?
Yes.
I'm sure I saw that. So I thought that was particularly interesting. Do you think this kind of affirmation of, yes, I can be special, even if I have these XYZ attributes, do you think that's a type of feminism for you, or not, or is that just part of the problem?
I think so. I can definitely see how people can, I guess, portray... Their political affiliations as like a manifestation, you know, as is so like often the case in the Disney princess films, as like a manifestation of pure love. There's like a fan art piece that I particularly like of Tiana and her best friend Charlotte protesting for Black Lives Matter. They're sort of like clasping hands and Charlotte is like wearing a t-shirt that reads "She can't breathe." and yeah, like you know, just this not even reimagining, really, because you know, sort of shifting of the characters into a modern context, but like retaining their, you know, their most positive qualities, you know, like that that Charlotte is so supportive of her best friend, and yeah, that they are like putting them into a guise where they can be sort of politically active, yeah, like, and in that sense, sort of yeah, pointing out that your politics can be like a manifestation of like unfailing transformative love.
I think that's one of the most impressive contributions of knowledge in your paper, is that you are emphasizing this as a transformational property, rather than say subverting the gender roles of the text. Because I think a very simplistic reading of Disney princess and this meme culture would be to say, oh, they're taking the traditional gender roles and they're tipping them on the head because they're feminist now, because they weren't feminist before. I think that's what's quite clever about your paper, is that you're trying to articulate exactly what's going on. It's not just about subverting the expectations of what a princess is. It's about saying, actually, we saw this in them already.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. You know, like in the example that I gave before, you know, like, why wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that, were we to transpose these characters into a modern context, that Charlotte wouldn't be, you know, supporting her best friend out of love and concern?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting. And the other thing that I was sort of, like, thinking about when you were saying this is that, is this being special about... What is it about the princess that is special? So you've got the glamour, you've got the attention, you've got the power, I guess. When these princesses in so many ways represent hegemonic normality, like, you know, the common sense of what is a normal girl, like, so to the extent that we've got, you know, horrific whitewashing and other sort of stuff as well. So what is that about for you?
I guess it's about this idea of... you know, almost like mastery over these like damaging constructs. In researching the paper, I found like an Onion article which had like, you know, fictional like respondents commenting on the creation of Disney's first Latina princess. And one of the fictional respondents said something like, "You know, you've made it as an ethnicity when there's a Disney princess of you." And I mean, I laughed, but I also thought that that's very much sort of the logic that. You know, it sort of shows that if there is a Disney princess who looks like you, then, you've transcended somehow. You've won out, which, as we can see, is, like, not all, like, I mean, you know, the creation of a Black Disney princess was count very much in the terms, you know, of, like, the election of Barack Obama. Like, you know, there can't be racism now because we have a Black president. There can't be racism now because we have a Black Disney princess. But even if these things are not, often borne out in reality. Mm. There's this idea that when Disney deigns to make a princess in your image, it means that your group has finally transcended the systematic limitations that have been put in place to prevent you from succeeding.
It's interesting in a way because it's almost like normalization.
Mm.
Like your inverted commas normal now,
yeah.
Which to me I find is quite unsettling and almost dangerous. Like that level of power has been given to Disney in terms of their representation, therefore means visibility, therefore means acceptance, therefore means like they can actually attribute a value judgment to that.
Mm.
In particular, I think with the Frog and the Princess, there's like mostly the concern was like more tokenistic than sort of, you know, exploring in depth some of the issues that face her in that time. Mm. And I guess the difficulty of being able to talk about that with children is quite tough, I feel. Yeah. So I think my final question is, with these fan spaces, I sort of think when you were talking in the final slide, I think it's just because it was quite condensed what you were trying to say. Is it for you like they're trying to escape into these fantasy spaces where they could potentially become a princess?
Mm.
Or is it something else? Because particularly with my Japanese participants in my research, they're deliberately constructing an alternative world where they are a princess and they do wear princess dresses and they do have various cute things and they have bedrooms and things like that. It's a bedroom culture. Mm. In a lot of ways, I saw that translating across into this fan culture, even though it's not a lived, embodied princess space.
Mm.
People in Tumblr often push and project their identities into the virtual space, like, you know, with various sexual identities or, you know, memes or kinks or things that they can identify with. So is it escapism, do you think, or something different?
I mean, I think there is some element of escapism, but I think there's also an element of, I guess, trying to bring this, idea of, like, love being transformative and, you know, like a seemingly everyday girl getting to be special and sort of trying to project it into lived experience and make it part of, you know, just part of the furniture. These films so often like pitch these female characters as just an ordinary girl, even if, you know, we can plainly see that, you know, very few people are like that in real life.
Mm.
But like the Disney films so often, ground these characters in an idea of everydayness and normalness. There's almost a sense of, using these characters that are so, central in the lives of, you know, many generations of people now and trying to use them as a strategy for, changing the world around you.
It's kind of interesting. I'm thinking, is it a matter of power? Mm-hmm. So princess equals power. Mm-hmm. Therefore, if I'm a princess, I am powerful. Or is it recognition? So, therefore I am more visible because of my particular set of demographic qualities are recognized and embodied in this princess. I am now recognized. I am real. My struggles are real. Or is I don't think you could have an answer for that. We'd have to interview thousands of people to get an accurate answer for that.
But it is a fascinating question.
Yeah. I think that's one of the difficulties when you start to study text is a limitation to how far, when it comes to fan cultures, you can sort of interpret what's going on in terms of audience perspectives and things like that.
Mm.
It's very much indicative of how these texts are very much alive still.
Mm.
And I think a lot of the vacuousness and emptiness of the princesses in many ways, the simplicity of just love, curiosity, exploration, love, it's kind of empty in so many ways, but it gives you so much space to fill it with things.
Mm.
So it's sort of like in a way like her Barbie is quite empty, but that's what gives her so much power is the ability for a child to pick it up and say, this Barbie can become, she's a doctor now, she's an astronaut now, she's a unicorn now, it doesn't matter, she's a carrot now, she could be whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, I think that's what's so special about it. I think it's very interesting what you've tapped into, and it'll be very interesting to see how you progress this kind of work if you choose to, because I think it's just getting bigger and bigger, particularly with the current young generation of teenage girls getting onto Tumblr now and meeting with, I'm going to guess we're about the same generation.
Yeah.
So I'm 28 and like most of my friends are doing exactly this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I recall very much that, because in my own teen years, Disney was not a mainstream thing, at least among my circle of, like, geeky friends. You could not admit openly to liking Disney, you know. So often what would happen would be friends would come over and we'd say, let's watch The Lion King, but to make fun of it. And so we would you know, justify our secret desire to watch The Lion King by, you know, poking fun at it and pausing the movie in, like, various places where the characters had, like, a goofy expression on their face. but I think part of what the Disney Princess, like, franchise and its, like, and the Disney Princess culture has wrought is that, a lot of the time, especially for young women, you know, yeah, princess culture is something that it is at least more acceptable to take with you from, like, babyhood right into adulthood. There's no period in the middle for a lot of women where you have to disavow this and pretend that you don't like it anymore, even if you secretly do.
I think it's an issue for men and women or other, in particular, like, if you look at work, Harry Blatterer is a sociologist who looks at adult culture and how adult culture is shifting, and so many people now maybe, like, say 30 are living at home while the two generations earlier would have already moved out and bought a house by now. So I think it's systemic across any kind of generation. It just manifests in different ways for different demographics, and that's what I think is so fascinating about it. And the other thing I was just going to say is that the point you had about feminism was very interesting, about feminism as a set of values becoming a value judgment of things. I think that's something very pertinent we need to keep in mind with these kinds of texts. As we were just discussing, it's like there's so much more sustenance to a text. It's just one reading. Yeah. Feminism is just one reading of a text, but it's now evolving into a way in which you consume things or a value judgment. I think it's problematic. It shuts down so much research potential once we say this isn't feminist enough. So, you know, again, with my kawaii girls, they're not feminists. They're not interested in feminism. They don't really know what it is. I could construe and say that their act is a feminist act, but that's me projecting my own values upon them and making a value judgment of their lives. And is that the right thing to do? Is that the ethical thing to do?
Yeah.
So that's the question we need to ask ourselves as we progress this kind of research about girly culture. Like, how can we ethically engage with this without projecting our own values and meanings onto the research?
That's very true.
Is there any questions from the audience? Yes.
I was going to ask you about, I did a bit of research and reading last year on The Revenant and its abundant misrepresentation, but also about how people were fascinated with the fact that it still managed to represent a whole group of Native American people that weren't otherwise seen on film. So it was lauded as being, you know, for the first time this many Native American actors had been on screen. But what was really interesting, when I did that reading, I managed to kind of go back to the late 90s and find one of the biggest anxieties that came out in Native American scholars with Pocahontas was that it was treated as pedagogy. And I thought it was really interesting that with what you were saying about the way that almost all of the princesses of color were treated, written into scenarios where it was historicized and this is an actual period in time versus being contemporary.
Yeah, she lives in the fantasy land of Andalasia that doesn't really exist.
Exactly. Yes. So, and I think it's really interesting because there's an element to which the failure to observe the kind of need for an intersectionality there is producing an attempt to make a character who is both providing that recognition of the particular identity that hasn't been recognized before, but also deeply concerned with still being palatable to the mainstream. So it's in the way that, you know, there have been conversations on about, you know, why it is so astonishing that Moonlight won the Oscar, and part of that is because of its the portion of the film that's set in the present versus other options which are about, well, clearly racism was a thing before, but we don't have to worry about it now. And there is, I think, probably an element to that within the Princesses of Colour that you discuss. And I guess I'm interested in the extent to which you think that the way those princesses are handled in a kind of like handle with care, fragile, sort of like don't say anything too offensive, but also don't say anything that will suggest that you're taking a position. And the way that the response on the part of the fans is to sort of like solidify some of those positions, like with the fan art about the Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. I guess I'm interested in the way that people are concerned with the films as a form of like teaching about these issues, and that they're given that responsibility and yet maybe don't deliver.
Yeah, I mean that. Yeah, particularly with you know, fans' ability to be to, you know, tweet directly at the company, tweet directly at the directors, writers, producers of these films. You know, contact them, make you know, make massive fan petitions for this kind of thing. It's sort of yeah, I think. I mean, to an extent, you know, we shouldn't like pretend that this is like a purely modern phenomenon. I think the like many Islamic groups came out in like uproar at Aladdin 20 plus years ago, saying that you know, yeah, saying quite rightly that you know, the opening lyrics of the song, you know, describing Agrabah as a place where they cut off your ear if you don't like, if they don't like your face, you know, were racially vilifying. But I think it's yeah, it's definitely yeah, it's definitely a very good point that these films so often have to tread this like dangerous middle ground between teaching people about these cultures, but also yeah, like teaching people about these cultures in a very American way. There's a lot of interesting writing on Mulan, for instance, which is based on like a beloved Chinese folk tale, which may or may not have its roots in actual history, but yeah, on the way that it portrays this like Americanized version of China, which was actually not well received in China at all. You know, they felt like it had kind of bastardized one of their beloved, like, you know, cultural icons. Yeah, so it is. It is, yeah, very noteworthy that this kind of, like, representational heavy lifting is so often, you know, required, like, is often demanded these days from a purely commercial company that makes, you know, enjoyable musicals for children. Yeah.
Anything else?
Yes.
I just have a question about nostalgia, really. It seems from my own observation and from your talk that those of us who were born in, say, the late 80s, because I was, and a few other people in here, I'm sure were, and grew up in the 90s, seem to have the most, I guess, the strongest engagement with Disney, not just Disney princess culture, but Disney in general, arguably, and more so than any other generation. And it seems from your talk that there are two reasons why that might be. Firstly, that the 90s was a sort of great era of films, Aladdin, Lion King, and Pocahontas, but also that we sort of, that our generation kind of intersected with those technological developments like VHS, DVD, as well as things like BuzzFeed, where we can play out our nostalgia that you always see on Facebook and those sort of things. But I'm wondering, do you think there's any other reason why our generation in particular has an engagement with Disney princess culture other than those sort of technological reasons?
I mean, increasingly, I talked mainly in terms of the franchise. I talked about how much the franchise is pitched to children because it is primarily a children's franchise. But there are also branches of it. You know, for instance, there's like a very big wedding industry involved yeah, like, you know, people will get married at the Disney parks. People will buy rings or dresses that are inspired by particular Disney princesses. You know, so like if you want to go like Grace Kelly classic, you dress like Cinderella. If you want something, you know, like more, I guess like, yeah, like flashy, like you dress in like the Jasmine dress. And so I think yeah, like even though this is like a very nostalgic franchise, there are avenues in which it's like interwoven with the rites of passage that accompany us into adulthood. I'm talking primarily about women here because that's my experience and that's what I've been researching, but yeah, like, you know, there are all kinds of different moves that they make nowadays to, not have it be purely something that you look back on with fondness, but something that you find ways to enact even in adult life.
So that lived culture, I think, is incredibly prolific in Japan. particularly through Disney's massive in Japan, and there are so many adult things like notebooks, you know, stationery, clothing that are produced for young women, like mothers as well, to consume as well. But particularly when you mentioned the wedding, I was just thinking, isn't that a fulfillment of a fantasy set up in the childhood, the childhood dream, like set up, because it follows the narrative of pretty much every princess story. She gets married.
Yeah, there is so often, there is, particularly in I think Disney films up to about 2009, they so often ended with a big lavish wedding.
Yeah.
Like, it's only in the last, it's only really since 2009 that the majority of Disney princess movies do not end with the characters, like, you know, exiting the church as everybody throws rice and cheers.
Well, I think that's what made Brave so, I think Brave is incredibly underrated, because the whole narrative is about her saying, I don't want to get married, I don't want to get married, I'm 13, man, this is weird, stop it.
For God's sakes, I'd be in year 11 at, like, high school, you know.
Was she 13 or?
I think she was meant to be 16, because, majority of the characters.
I feel a bit better now.
Yeah.
Only marginally, but, you know, I thought she was 13, but... Also, as an interesting side fact, in Japan, you do have your Disney princess wedding, but it's compulsory to have Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck at your reception.
Wow.
In costume, and you cannot opt out of it. What is really interesting is that Disney Park in Tokyo is one of the first places to support gay marriage as well.
Ceremonies.
Yeah, so because I'm not sure about the legality of it at the time when they did it, but there was like one that covered the news. It's like two women dressed as princesses and got married at the Disney Princess Castle. But again, that ties in very specifically with a very specific gender narrative set up for Japanese women. But I think, I think it's interesting in some way. Is it nostalgia to get married as a Disney princess, or is it living a fantasy that you had as a child?
I mean, I would...
is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing? I don't know. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I think... I would say that it, like, from my perspective, it falls more into the living out of a fantasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A bit of both, really.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I was trying to think what other factors would contribute to why there's so much attachment to these genres. I think it's just because, in a lot of ways, the Disney princess merchandising has come out specifically in this time frame. So, like, it's the media and, like, the shops and everything is heavily saturated with Disney and Disney media. Like the vaults were stopped, that concept of the vault was stopped, and the, you know, mass production of products everywhere.
And there's products that are pitched at, like, every single possible price bracket. I mean, you know, you can get $2, like, you know, Disney princess pencils in the stationery store, but you can also get, you know, statuettes and, like, very detailed dolls and, you know, replica dresses that, like, run into the hundreds, even thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Like, it is, it's, like, simultaneously, like, a children's brand and a luxury brand, almost. They can get people to pay this money because they have such a, you know, a, like, powerful emotional attachment to these characters.
It's kind of interesting in a way that I'm sort of situating now the Tumblr girls. Like, is it counterculture then if it's so, if the main Disney track is so prolific and hegemonic? Is the Tumblr culture counterculture to that? Is it trying to sort of carve up a new alternative space, or is it just feeding into the mainstream narrative? Which is it? I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Perhaps to follow on from that point, I mean, how is the Disney company's response to these kind of fan art pieces, like the one you've got on the screen behind you? I mean, particularly based on your earlier commentary that within this broader Disney princess narrative, that all of the princesses maintain their own individual kind of fantasy networks.
You'll never see anyone giving anyone else a noogie in the official art.
So what does Disney think of this kind of stuff? Is it like this kind of hardcore Nintendo thing where they're just like, just stop it? This is illegal. We will sue you.
I mean, I do recall maybe about... 5-6 years ago now, there was a YouTube parody that I remember. It was the opening sequence of Beauty and the Beast. Only all of Belle's singing had been dubbed over with like a kind of flamboyant gay guy like singing, you know, yeah, it was called Bonjour Girl, and it was like, it was,
oh,
yeah,
I've
if
seen
Bell,
that.
Yeah,
I've
if
seen
Bell
it, yeah.
was, if Bell had the inner monologue of like a, you know, a flamboyant like guy who vacations at Fire Island, you know, yeah, like, you know, his, yeah, like that, what that, how somebody with that experience would respond to, you know, the snubbing of the townspeople. And I remember it was taken down from YouTube, but it recently, in the intervening 5 years, when these Disney princess parodies and commentaries and listicles and editorials and campaigns and petitions have become so widespread, interestingly, in the with the recent release of the you know, the live action version of Beauty and the Beast, that parody resurfaced on YouTube again. Like, you know, I don't know whether it was a duplicate or whether the original person was allowed to repost it, but it seems almost like, yeah, Disney maybe has less of an incentive to, like, you know, put out, like, cease and desist notices because they realize that this kind of thing reinforces people's connection with their brand.
Yeah. Well, I think... Yeah. I think actually they're actually trying to cash in on that now, because I've noticed that, I think it's BuzzFeed, they've got a lot of the, like, the actors for the Beauty and the Beast now doing videos, like they were doing like Which Disney Princess Quiz Are You, and like things like that, so I suspect that's what they're just rolling with it now.
Yeah.
The other example next to Nintendo is Barbie's Mattel's Barbie, yeah. Which I think is very interesting, just how crazy controlling they are.
Yeah.
So they are pretty relaxed with Disney, surprisingly.
I suppose also once you get into remakes, there is no definitive version.
Yeah.
It just spawns on more and more, so you can't say no, there is only one Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah.
You can say that. It's the 99.
I respect you, but also you're wrong.
Anyway, on that note, I think we should wrap up. So thank you for the lovely talk, and thank you for your wonderful questions, guys.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @SSSNetwork, like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.